Welcome to Counterspin, your weekly look behind the headlines of the mainstream news. I'm Janine Jackson, here with Steve Rendell. This week on Counterspin, sure, Million Dollar Baby is just a movie, but given how rarely the media spotlight ever makes it around to people with disabilities, the movie is bound to shape public opinion and understanding. So the questions provoked by the film would seem to deserve more thoughtful and inclusive journalistic treatment than they've thus far received. We'll talk about media coverage of the controversial film and its ostensible message with NBC reporter John Hockenberry, author of Moving Violations, War Zones, Wheelchairs, and Declarations of Independence. Also on the show, the average U.S. media consumer might think democracy and freedom were flourishing in the Middle East. The latest round of media happy talk began with the reporting on the January 30th Iraq elections. And since then, the U.S. media have provided a stream of rosy reporting about democracy on the march in Iraq and elsewhere in the region. Independent, unembedded journalist Dar Jamail has just returned from Iraq. He'll join us with another view. That's coming up, but first, as usual, we'll take a look back at recent press.
On February 28th, USA Today ran a piece headlined, Social Security Fight Gets Personal. The article led with an ad from the right-wing group USA Next, which falsely claimed that the American Association for Retired Persons was pro-gay marriage and anti-soldier. One could call that getting personal, perhaps, though other words might describe it better. But what were the comparable actions made by the other side? USA Today gave two examples. A liberal group criticized a Louisiana congressman who has raked in big campaign contributions from financial interests likely to profit from privatization. The paper also noted that the AFL-CIO has claimed that big brokerage firms stand to make considerable profits by managing private accounts. But neither of those charges is scurrilous, and they're both true. That same tendency to balance things that aren't really comparable was on display in a February 27th Washington Post piece headlined, Partisan Social Security Claims Questioned. Budget experts say both sides flawed. The piece starts with a Bush falsehood, his claim that the system will be flat bust in 40 years. Then they get to what they call a Democratic falsehood. Democrats say the switch to privatization will cost $4 trillion. The Post says such claims are, quote, as debatable and politically motivated as Bush's $754 billion estimate, close quote. But the evidence the Post gathers suggests otherwise. Bush's low estimate covers the next 10 years, but the accounts won't be fully implemented for another 6 years, so his numbers are obviously suspect. The $4 trillion price tag, on the other hand, is the estimated cost for 20 years. And even Dick Cheney has agreed that the plan will cost trillions of dollars. But somehow for the Post, this is all just Democratic deception. All of this effort to put a pox on both houses sure seems like an attempt to avoid saying the obvious, that the White House isn't telling the truth about Social Security.
And if your head hurts a little every time you hear the White House plan to dismantle Social Security described as reform, you aren't alone. Now, apparently at least one outlet has decided that it just isn't good journalism to describe a highly controversial plan using the leading language of its advocates. On February 8th, NPR's Washington editor, Ron Elving, sent a memo to staffers instructing them to cease using the word reform to describe the White House privatization plan and to seek what he called more neutral words, like change. For those who find the whole thing trivial, NPR's Brooke Gladstone pointed out in a February 28th on-air discussion that he who controls the language controls the debate. She also noted that they had asked ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, and The Wall Street Journal to comment on their own word choices. They all declined.
And on more language that could stand examination, when a suicide bomber struck outside a club in Tel Aviv late on February 25th, the Los Angeles Times announced on its front page the next day, "Attack shatter calm in Mideast." The Times claimed in the article's lead paragraph that the attack, quote, shattered a months-long period of relative calm, close quote. Well, the bombing was a terrible event. It killed 4 Israelis and injured 50. But did it really shatter a long period of calm? The piece later noted that Israelis had been, quote, comforted by 4 months of calm, close quote, which covered the amount of time since the last suicide bombing against them took place. But during that period, as Allison Weir of the group If Americans Knew, pointed out on counterpunch.org, 170 Palestinian men, women, and children were killed by Israeli forces, and 379 were injured. Israeli demolition of Palestinian homes also continued during those 4 months of relative calm. The Times made a slight nod to that reality, noting deep within the article that, quote, despite the lull, several Palestinians have been killed in various incidents, including one who was shot to death Friday in Gaza by Israeli soldiers, close quote. But curiously, none of those incidents of violence against Palestinians were able to shatter the Times' apparent notion that calm exists when only Palestinians are being killed.
Robert Novak's February 25th Chicago Sun-Times column read like a flashback to the Reagan era. In the column, Novak warned that Marxist-Leninism was again on the march in Central and South America, citing as proof the emergence of what are, in fact, left-leaning populist governments, and the fact that a Sandinista general had been appointed chief of the Nicaraguan army. But Novak saved his most rancorous words for Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez, whom he described as the Marxist mastermind behind this creeping Latin American communism, a scourge he called, quote, the infection spreading throughout America's backyard, close quote. Novak also claimed without evidence that Chavez is a supporter of the Colombian rebels known as the FARC. Now, never mind that the democratically elected Chavez rejects the FARC and Marxism, which he's taken pains to distinguish from his own populist Bolivarian philosophy. Novak has never let facts get in the way of red-baiting perceived enemies in support of U.S. nationalism. In the 1980s, he regularly portrayed murderous U.S. allies as champions of democracy, while labeling democratic activists and organizations communist. Various investigations and truth commissions have revealed that the Reagan-era policies Novak was promoting resulted in hundreds of thousands of deaths and disappearances, as well as widespread torture. Now, Bob Novak may not be keeping that history in mind as he writes his current columns, but readers should.
And finally, anchor Peter Jennings introduced a February 28th segment about how freedom is on the march in the Middle East, like so. Quote, ABC's Terry Moran has been watching this today from the perspective of the White House. And he reports tonight that the Bush administration thinks this is very good news, close quote. Well, the report that followed was just that, the White House's spin on how democracy and freedom are busting out all over the Middle East. As ABC reporter Terry Moran put it, quote, the president might well be excited about what's been happening in the Middle East in the past few weeks. The January elections in Iraq. In Saudi Arabia 2 weeks ago, limited local elections were held, the first ever in that country, close quote. Moran went on to talk about democratic developments in Egypt and Palestine, remarking, quote, amid all of this, analysts say the best thing the U.S. can do is step back, close quote. And, Moran might have added, take credit for it all. The cheerleading went uninterrupted, except for Moran's brief mention that some unnamed experts say that, quote, stirrings of reform have been around in the region for years, close quote, a comment he quickly followed up with, quote, but there's no doubt, Peter, that tonight something is afoot in the Middle East, close quote. In fact, there are no significant democratic developments in Saudi Arabia or Egypt or any other nations ruled by despotic U.S. allies. It's all just talk at this point. What is afoot in the Middle East is a U.S. public relations campaign to sell U.S. interests and an aggressive military policy as a crusade for democracy and freedom. But for that kind of critical analysis, journalists would, of course, have to go beyond the White House for their perspective.
Thanks, Steve. You are listening to Counterspin. Counterspin is brought to you each week by the Media Watch Group Fair. Those concerned with issues the media usually ignore are supposed to get excited when the spotlight swings their way. But the bit of press attention being devoted to the lives of people with disabilities as a result of the Oscar-winning movie Million Dollar Baby hasn't exactly been encouraging about media's ability to handle these issues with subtlety. In fact, in what looks like a rush to dismiss the whole thing as a passing brouhaha over what is, after all, only a movie, much of the press corps appear eager to sidestep the issue of what what the film seems to say about the lives of people with disabilities. And that's a conversation that many in the disability rights community would very much like to have. Joining us now to talk about Million Dollar Baby is veteran journalist John Hockenberry, now at NBC News, and author of the book Moving Violations, War Zones, Wheelchairs, and Declarations of Independence. Welcome back to Counterspin, John Hockenberry.
It's great to be here, Janine.
Well, Million Dollar Baby, listeners will know at this point, tells the story of a female boxer who left quadriplegic after a spinal cord injury, asks her father figure trainer, played by Clint Eastwood, also the film's director, to kill her, which he does. Now, listeners will have heard that there's heated criticism of the film, but they may not have heard distinctions being made about the various critiques. Would you talk about your own concerns about Million Dollar Baby?
Well, first of all, they may not have even heard the context of this entire discussion because critics and the entire media establishment went out of its way to protect consumers and the marketers of the movie from knowing the ending. And somehow if they knew the ending, the controversial ending, it would have spoiled the movie for them. The surprise ending being this kind of tragic, euthanized experience where Hilary Swank, yet once again, in an Oscar-winning performance, is killed off by some male. That irony is not what we're here to address. The issue for me really was that this is offensive. I mean, it's offensive just because it's so massively unreal. Eastwood is playing on a kind of sentimentality which really is at the core of the myth about disability in the United States, that it is some absolute tragedy that all people with disabilities do is sit around and overcome their obstacles, or if they don't do that kind of thing, if they're not engaged in some sort of utterly courageous kind of pageant of personal fulfillment, they kill themselves. And neither, of course, is the case, because people with disabilities, and there are millions and millions of them, are living completely full lives that range over the full diversity of the American experience. Yet, somehow, quadriplegia is a universally recognized excuse to check out. And I find that offensive. And I find preserving the surprise ending for moviegoers as the supreme value here to be even more offensive. Imagine if at the end of some Eddie Murphy movie, there was like a comic lynching, and the movie reviewers attempted to, preserve the surprise ending, even though there was some controversy about it. I mean, it's utterly absurd. Or imagine, a kind of at the end of the Nicolas Cage movie, they discover that, in fact, the Holocaust didn't exist. There would be no, defenses on the grounds that, well, hey, it's just a movie and this is fiction. No. It would be an absolute wasp's nest in flames. So clearly this demonstrates two things quickly. One, the standing of people with disabilities in our culture, which is nil. And secondly, we're not even permitted to express outrage. It somehow becomes Clint Eastwood's being, attacked by the Christian right. And I noticed that Frank Rich and a lot of the commentators who glommed onto the story were way too scared to characterize it from a disability perspective and were much more comfortable going for the criticism by the Christian right, who also had some objections to the film.
Well, that's kind of a debate that they're familiar with, you might say. And I think part of the problem that we're both pointing to is our fear of the narrowness of the media window. If you can't reveal the movie's ending until it's won an Oscar, then the whole conversation about the questions raised by the movie, may get lost completely.
Well, not only does it get lost, it says that the media is, in fact, part of the marketing of the movie. And so basically the discussions, these sort of ginger tiptoeing around the actual issue discussions of the controversy were all part of the marketing of the movie, and that was the supreme value. Let's definitely not keep people from seeing the movie. I don't care whether people see the movie or not. And it's interesting, since I submitted to a blog called milliondollarbigot.org, I've received lots and lots of emails from, well-meaning people who claim that I'm some sort of censor who would have Clint Eastwood taken away or not permitted to release his movie, when in fact I'm simply another reviewer. I'm a reviewer. I observe this phenomenon in the movie to be offensive based on my own experience, and somehow I'm not permitted to say that, according to these people, that I have a narrow view and that fiction is supposed to be like open-ended. And unfortunately, art has consequences, and this happens to be one of them.
and can spur a conversation in which we can all participate. Well, let me ask you, columnist Ellen Goodman was one of those who wrote that the film wasn't about what you or I ought to do in that situation, finding ourselves quadriplegic. It's about what a character named Maggie chose to do. Now,
we've already addressed
the idea that it's only a movie, but what about this idea that to criticize the film is to say that people who are disabled never want to kill themselves, or they're wrong to make that choice? What about that line?
Well, first of all, it's not a matter of right or wrong in terms of the disability experience. It just doesn't happen. I mean, there's more of a public health problem of teenagers committing suicide. Teenagers who appear in lots and lots of movies. There's no teenager who asks at the end of a Hollywood movie to be euthanized. And if there were, even though statistically that would be more plausible than what happened in Million Dollar Baby, it just wouldn't fly in Hollywood, because that's just not how – that's another myth that Hollywood is involved in. But my problem with Ellen Goodman is that she doesn't explore her own notion of this being plausible. She assumes that because she found it plausible, therefore it is. And therefore, there's this kind of detached notion of, well, here's a character who wanted this, and we'll just let her do it. That it's about freedom. It's not about freedom. It's not at all about freedom. And you know, clearly, Clint Eastwood needed an ending for his movie. And I refer in my blog to this being the crip ex machina, a dramatic device to end this movie.
Well, and I think you're touching on a point that many people have made, which is that it seems to be about, don't people have a right to make this choice? And it isn't so much that we can't have that conversation, but why can we not have a conversation about what it is that leads someone to make a choice like that, or would? Poor quality of life, lack of treatment. What about people who choose to live? I think that's the question. Let me ask you about Clint Eastwood, because it is part of the story. It's relevant here who Clint Eastwood is and his history here.
Well, Clint has run afoul of the ADA, and in a very celebrated case when he was mayor of Carmel and owned a hotel there, he had a run-in with a lawyer who sued his facility for not having an accessible bathroom. And I don't know the precise details of it, but, you know, Clint Eastwood, first of all, was able to, by virtue of his visibility and profile as a celebrity, characterize himself as a victim, being victimized by a lot of opportunistic attorneys who were trying to extort money from him. At no point was the issue of accessibility ever really addressed, and Eastwood appeared on every talk show and testified before Congress. And again, the actual people whom this law was supposed to help never appeared at all in this drama. It was all about lawyers versus poor Clint Eastwood. And so, you know, his level of cynicism and bitterness about this particular population, I think, is well known. And so when his movie has this particular problem, it says something more than just, you know, it's about art.
Any final thoughts? Say we've got 30 seconds left.
I just wish people would, you know, see this as a learning opportunity. The fact that this outrage about the movie exists ought to broaden people's understanding. It shouldn't cause a kind of circling the wagons in this culture war where people with disabilities are ignored, and somehow if people with disabilities don't want to commit suicide, they're weird in some way. And that really, I think, unfortunately, is going to be the legacy, especially since the movie is, imagine if Helen Keller committed suicide in Miracle Worker. Be a little different movie, don't you think?
We've been speaking with John Hockenberry, now at NBC News. John Hockenberry is also the author of the book Moving Violations, War Zones, Wheelchairs, and Declarations of Independence. Thank you very much for joining us on Counterspin.
My pleasure.
To listen to the White House and U.S. media tell it, one might get the impression that the entire Middle East has been engulfed in a blissful state of democracy and freedom. And it's all thanks to the White House. The headline on a February 28th Forbes magazine article that reads, "Why Millions Say Softly, God Bless America," is only slightly more exaggerated than the theme taken up by many other mainstream outlets. When did all this happy news talk about the Middle East begin? That's easy. It started with the coverage of the January 30th elections in Iraq, which were declared a smashing success by U.S. media outlets. Joining us now with another view is independent journalist Dar Jamail. Jamail has spent much of the last year as an unembedded reporter in Iraq, covering stories that mainstream media largely missed. You can read his reporting and commentary on Iraq at his website at darjamailiraq.com. Dar Jamail, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks very much for having me.
Dar, having recently returned from Iraq and getting an earful and eyeful of U.S. reporting on Iraq, what strikes you most about the coverage?
Well, the disparity continues to baffle me that I see between the actual reportage and what's happening on the ground, particularly with the election, with it not being reported accurately as Iraqis voting essentially to end the occupation, rather it being portrayed as sort of a signal that the occupation is a success and Iraqis are happy about it. But even more after that now is this essential vanishing of Iraq from much of the media after the 30th and conveniently being replaced with stories about Iran and Syria. Meanwhile, the situation on the ground in Iraq continues to degrade every single day.
Well, I want to stay on the elections for just a second more. Most Americans got their news about Iraq and the elections from a relatively small number of largely sequestered U.S. reporters in Iraq. Can you tell us about that and your thoughts a little more about the coverage of the elections?
Well, another aspect of this that has been largely missed in the mainstream reportage of the elections is the fact that there were only, in Baghdad, for example, there were only four polling stations that the media were allowed to go to. These were in predominantly Shia neighborhoods. There was extra security there. Voter turnout was expected to be high, which it was. And it's only from these small areas, these few areas, that most of the reportage on the elections arose from. And it, of course, is a very biased view of what happened and, of course, a complete lack of context about the elections as far as the fact that Iraqis were frustrated because most of the candidates were anonymous, their political platforms were unknown. And then, of course, as I mentioned, the fact that people were voting to end the occupation as opposed to the idea put forth by the mainstream that people were essentially voting as if voting in support of the occupation.
What about violence on Election Day? It was basically reported here that the elections were a smashing success and that actually there was, if anything, less violence on that day than in days before and after. What was the truth on that?
Well, again, it was mentioned as an afterthought, the fact that there was countless attacks up and down Iraq. There were at least 40 people killed on that day and over 200 wounded. And this was either not reported at all or mentioned as a bit of an afterthought, like that was an acceptable number. And I wonder how the mainstream would report it if we had an election here in the States and 40 Americans were killed in mortar attacks and car bombs and over 200 wounded. Would it just be an afterthought? Would that be an acceptable situation here?
Well, speaking just generally about the situation in Iraq, what is the situation there now as far as security and rebuilding and some of these other stories that we were told by Fox, for instance, before the election were positive stories that the media was not reporting?
Well, as we approach the two-year mark of the occupation, which is right around the corner now, infrastructure remains in complete shambles. In the better areas of Baghdad, there are 6 hours of electricity per day, while most of Iraq, excepting Kurdistan, has 3 hours or less electricity per day. There's still well over 50% unemployment, a gasoline crisis, and the security situation is quite abominable. More and more people are choosing to stay in their homes rather than to brave the streets where car bombings, fighting, kidnappings, and criminal activity has become the norm.
And what about rebuilding?
Rebuilding, the same story there, really. Most reconstruction projects have ground to a complete halt, even though Bechtel, for example, has been paid out in full for their initial contract, $680 million. Water treatment plants, for example, remain in shambles. There's been some projects that where work has continued and a couple where there has been some completion, but overall, Iraq remains, the infrastructure remains in complete disrepair throughout much of the country.
Well, it was about $200 billion ago that the U.S. government, the White House, told us that Iraqi oil revenues would pay for the entire project there, the military operations and the rebuilding. What is the state of revenues from Iraqi oil, as you understand it now?
Well, Iraqi oil production continues to remain below pre-war levels, just as the electricity does as well, even admitted to by the commander of the Army Corps of Engineers. But no, that assumption that Iraqi oil money would basically cover this whole enterprise has proven very, very off the mark.
Finally, you must have spent some time with U.S. mainstream reporters. Do you have any observations about how they went about their jobs and how they covered Iraq?
most of the mainstream reporters operating in Iraq don't leave their hotels unless they are going to embed with the military, go into the green zone to the press information center, or go to an area that the military tells them that it's okay to go to. So essentially, it is basically hotel journalism that is occurring there, with people relying either on Iraqi contacts or even much more heavily relying on Pentagon and military information about what's happening there. And that's, in general, why what we're seeing is basically a stenography for the Pentagon, which is what the corporate media in Iraq is tending to act as.
Dar Jamail, if you were an editor in charge of a team of reporters in Iraq, what do you think would be the most important story that you would send them to cover?
Right now, I would send them to cover the story of uranium munitions. It has been the most underreported and yet remains one of the most important stories on the ground there. If we even just look at the numbers from the 91 Gulf War, we have at least 60% of the Gulf War vets, U.S. soldiers, who are now on permanent medical disability for this quote-unquote Gulf War syndrome. And we look at Iraq now, much, much more depleted uranium has been used, soldiers staying there for well over a year at a time, many on their second tour now, and this is simply not being reported. And the ramifications are going to be quite astounding, and I would have people covering this as much as possible.
And the ramifications for the Iraqi population as well, I would think.
Without a doubt, even more so for the Iraqi population, where we've already seen skyrocketing cancer rates just after the 91 Gulf War, and now even much more so.
We've been speaking with Dar Jamail, an independent and unembedded journalist, just recently returned from Iraq. You can visit his website at darjamailiraq.com. That's DahrJamail, Iraq.com. Dar Jamail, thanks for joining us today on Counterspin.
Thanks very much for having me.
And that's it for Counterspin for this week. Counterspin is produced by the staff and interns at the Media Watch Group Fair, based in New York. Fair also publishes a bi-monthly magazine called Extra. For subscription information, you can call the following number, 1-800-847-3993. That number again is 1-800-847-3993. Be sure and tell them that you heard about Extra here on Counterspin. For more information about FAIR, you can check out our website. It's www.fair.org. The show is engineered by Kelly Spivey at Mercer Media. With me is Steve Rendell. I'm Janine Jackson. Thank you for listening to Counterspin.